Home is where the heart is, yes. It is also where the money is. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, today the 27th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We bring you at the top of the program today from the National Association of Realtors, the Pending Home Sales Index, a measure of contracts signed to buy homes, defined here as existing single-family homes, condos, and co-ops. We will get, actually, later on in the program, to what makes a home, but to the housing news of the day, the pending home sales index was up 8.1% in January. That is to say, the second straight month of more contracts signed. And the number of existing homes on the market is improving as well, even though by historical measures, it is still really, really low. And that tight inventory is bad news for would-be home buyers. But you know who it is good news for? Home builders. Marketplace's Matt Levin has this one.
There's always about a zillion reasons not to move. Renting that unwieldy truck, fumbling with that weird packing tape dispenser that never works. And for homeowners who refinanced during the pandemic housing boom, reason one zillion and one is pretty compelling. Rafe Jadrasich covers the home building industry for Bank of America.
So over 80% of current homeowners now have a mortgage rate under 4%.
Which makes the prospect of financing at today's rate of 6.5% on a 30-year fix not so enticing.
The incentive for existing home inventory to come on the market is really, really low right now. So we'd expect existing homes sales to remain under pressure and pushing more people into the new home market.
The home builder Toll Brothers reported new home sales last month were better than January sales for most of the last two decades. New homes are gaining popularity partly because the cost of fixing up a fixer-upper keeps rising, says Jessica Louts at the National Association of Realtors.
41% of people who purchase a new property are actually doing so because they want to avoid the renovations.
Even with home builders benefiting from low inventory now, they'd much prefer to see lower mortgage rates. Demand would be much higher for both old and new homes. And with rates so high now, many of the people buying brand new homes are those that don't have to borrow in the first place. Rob Dietz is with the National Association of Home Builders.
Generationally, that buyer is going to be a Gen Xer who's in the peak of earning years. It's going to be a baby boomer who maybe can purchase with all cash.
First-time home buyers? Well, how long can you live in a fixer-upper without fixing it up? I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders kind of put last week's disappointments behind them. Kinda. They sent all three major indices a little higher. Kinda. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A lot of us, early on in the pandemic, started buying stuff, a lot of stuff. And we've talked about that and what it did to supply chains. Among the items a lot of us bought, PCs, which is why, says the research firm Gartner, that global personal computer shipments fell more than 16% last year because most of us have what we need. But there is some data from the Commerce Department this morning that showed manufacturers ordered more computers and other electronics in January. And in fact, that those commercial orders have been rising through much of the pandemic. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on that story.
The kind of equipment we're talking about isn't just desktop computers. It's also electronic components.
Think about ag equipment. Ag equipment is doing really well, and there's a whole bunch of electronics on a piece of agricultural equipment.
That's Tim Fiore with the Institute for Supply Management. He says there are plenty of other growing industries that need this kind of equipment, too.
Component manufacturing, signal processors for automotive, aerospace and defense.
Another reason some companies are investing in computers and other electronics is because they're trying to make up for labor shortages, says David Garfield with the consulting company Alex Partners. He says many businesses are spending more on automation and better software.
All of these things also require heavy-duty infrastructure and investments in hardware.
And even though consumers have been buying fewer computers, businesses tend to have a faster replacement cycle, says Andrew Hewitt, senior analyst with Forrester.
even if, you know, organizations in 2020 went out and refreshed their entire fleet, they're about getting to that point now where they're going to be starting to refresh some of those.
Especially, Hewitt says, because a lot of people have been using their work computers more during the pandemic.
Particularly if people are working at home 8, 9, 10 hours a day, you know, they're putting a lot of strain on the PC, and it's actually forced a lot of the decision makers that I talk to embrace a faster refresh because the devices just aren't lasting as long.
And Hewitt says computer supply chains are improving too, so importing them is getting faster. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
For all the conversation that's happening in this economy about the Federal Reserve, and yes, okay, it's not everybody talking about the Fed, maybe just some of us, but for all of that talk about what the Fed's doing and whether it should be doing it, there's also a conversation happening within the central bank about what it's doing. Gina Smilek covers the Federal Reserve for the New York Times. She's also a regular on this program, and her new book is about that very conversation. It's called Limitless: The Federal Reserve Takes on a New Age of Crisis. Gina, it's really good to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start by reading a little bit of you back to yourself. It's early in the book. You have a whole introduction in which you lay out the thesis of this book and how people view the Federal Reserve, and some think they're superheroes and some think they're ruining the world. And then you say about your own book, this is the tale of a mighty but fallible institution and a moment of intense soul searching. Describe that soul searching for me.
Right. So I've been covering the Fed for, you know, off and on about a decade now. And over that period, I've really watched them grapple with what their role in modern society is. The Fed's sort of traditional, original job was to step up and save the economy in times of financial crisis. And then it added on to that, you know, the job that we're most familiar with when it comes to the Fed, which is keeping inflation stable and fostering maximum employment. And then I think in the modern era, it's being asked to also do all kinds of new things like policing climate risk and responding to some really big societal issues that they've often said, you know, these aren't our job, but which are increasingly central to the economy, from inequality to racial equity. It is easily the most powerful economic policymaker we have. And just how powerful, you know, should it be? Where should the limits be? And so that's sort of the thesis at the center of the book.
There are a lot of ghosts in this book, and I obviously that's metaphorical, but some of them are very real. And I want to play a piece of tape now, and then I want to talk about it. And the reason I say there are a lot of ghosts is that you lay out the history of the Fed, and you talk a lot about how the present-day central bank is grappling with some of that history. So let's play this piece of tape, and I'll ID it on the back end.
Let me say with all the conviction I can muster, had you let that inflation, had we collectively let that inflation go ahead, eventually we would have had much more severe economic difficulties than in fact we have had. The quicker you can take care of these problems, the better off.
There are those who will recognize that as Paul Volcker. That's his reconfirmation hearings, I think. And talking obviously about the inflation for which he has become famous in breaking the back of. And what I want to understand is how the Fed today views the Fed of Volcker's era, because it is ever present. He is ever present.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that reconfirmation hearing in particular is something I've just rewatched over and over again. That was, I think, the sort of foundational time that the Fed grappled with a huge runaway inflation problem, that it took on this mantle of being the central policymaker dealing with it. And it, you know, it won. It won a very painful battle against inflation in the 1970s and 80s, and it took credit for winning. That became very much the way the Fed viewed itself. It became the Fed's narrative about itself. And I think it incredibly importantly informs the way the Fed is thinking about the current experience with inflation.
So we go from Volcker through the Greenspan era, then to Bernanke and Yellen, and now Jay Powell. And the Federal Reserve has come in that 40-ish something years quite a long way. And I want to talk about how Powell sees the Fed today? And Jay, let's hit that Powell Audience 2019 cut.
Our audience has become more varied, more attuned to our actions, and less trusting of public institutions. Gone are the days when the Federal Reserve Chair could joke, as my predecessor Alan Greenspan did, "If I turn out to be particularly clear, you probably misunderstood what I said."
Powell came out in either his first or second press conference and said, "I want to speak directly to the American people, and I want you to understand what I'm saying because it matters to you." This is a change.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's so interesting. And if you will indulge me for a moment, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. You know, the Volcker era Fed was intentionally obscure. You know, they targeted the money supply partially because targeting the money supply was effectively just raising interest rates. It was the same thing that we do with the Fed today, but it was a way to do it in a really painful way without having to talk about it so much because it was pretty complicated and most people didn't understand what was happening. You know, David Wessel in the Wall Street Journal, when he was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, once compared them to the Wizard of Oz, like pulling levers in the background. But as society progressed and as things opened up, as we got more transparency in government, that's started really not working. You know, we saw by the late Greenspan era that the Fed had started to open up. But Chair Powell really, I think, looked around when he got into office, which, you know, for context, we need to remember that this is sort of the Trump administration. And it's this moment of intense skepticism of government. And he really answered that with a lot of transparency. And so I think that it's been this really, really interesting transition to watch because, of course, you're going to make some mistakes when you're trying to move from a very secretive institution to a very open one.
We talked a good long while, Gina and I did. Part two of that conversation coming up in just a little bit. Coming up,
our kids had grown and two of them barely fit their beds anymore.
The joys of parenting in a home on wheels. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 72 points today, about 0.2%, 32,889. The NASDAQ also up 72 points, 0.6% on that index, ended at 11,466. The S&P 500 added 12 points, about 0.3%, 39,082. Union Pacific charged up 10% after an upgrade from Bank of America. The railroad operator announced that its CEO would be stepping down this year. That happens a lot. Share price goes up when the CEO steps out. Pfizer faded 2.3% today. The pharma giant is in talks with Seagen about acquiring the cancer drug maker in a multi-billion dollar deal. Seagen shot up more than 10%. Looking at home builder stocks after Matt Levin's story, Pulte Group climbed 0.2%. D.R. Horton lifted about 0.3%. Bond prices went up as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 3.92%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I was talking to Gina Smilek before the fold, Fed reporter at the New York Times, a Friday regular here. We were talking about her new book. It's called Limitless. And we'd left off with the Federal Reserve as an institution in transition from a place that has historically worked very much in secrecy to one that is trying real hard to be more open. Do you think it's working?
You know, I will say, I think that it has been interesting to watch for me as a Fed reporter, and I'm sure you've noticed this as well. You see a lot more of the Fed on sort of general news audience facing media these days. I think that we see it as less of an expert topic and something more something that everybody cares about. I also, you know, I, as the person who sits at the New York Times and writes about this, I feel like I have some degree of a front row seat to this transition, because I'm often the one kind of trying to figure out who our audience is. And I think our audience has become a lot more general. And I get a lot of mail that is not coming from investment professionals. It's coming from, you know, retirees. It's coming from college students. It's coming from all over the place.
That's fascinating. And let me get the plug in one more time. This is a great book, and it's a completely English language explanation of what happens with the Fed. There's great history and then the current policy stuff, which is where I want to get to now. I want to play one more piece of tape. It's Jay Powell talking to the aforementioned David Wessel, then at the Wall Street Journal, now, of course, at Brookings. So this is April of 2020. The Fed has really started to pull out all the stops. And here's what Powell tells David Wessel.
We have to find unusual and exigent circumstances. The Treasury Secretary has to agree. And we are using this fiscal backstop. But there's no limit on how much of that we can do, other than that it must meet the tests under the law as amended by Dodd-Frank.
No limit. No limit.
No limit. Limitless, if you will.
I will. I will indeed. Explain to me why that was so important that you titled your book after that moment.
Yeah. So when we founded the Fed, it was really a crisis fighter. The idea behind the Fed was that we kept having these horrible banking crises, and they were ruining the economy, and they were doing it on an every few years basis. And so the Fed was created to avert meltdowns, to make sure that we didn't have a financial crisis every few years. And it has a set of powers that is available to it in order to do that. And in 2020, we really saw the Fed use those powers that have been beefed up over the years in ways that it's never used them before. We saw the Fed step up and save the corporate bond market. It saved the municipal bond market. It created a Main Street lending program. Every kind of credit that you can basically think of, it created some sort of safety net to make sure that it didn't crash at the onset of the coronavirus. And it was really effective. There was a financial crisis at the start of 2020, but I bet most of your listeners don't know that. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, most people I talk to do not realize that this happened, because they stopped it so incredibly quickly. And so I think that this is going to be a real flashpoint for them going forwards, because we now know what the Fed can do. But in 2020, there wasn't a lot of sort of soul searching tied to that, because, you know, it was a pandemic. It was nobody's fault. But I think the next time you get a crisis that maybe is somebody's fault, where markets are melting down because it's because somebody took a bad bet, as we have seen happen, you know, repeatedly over the decades, so this isn't really a hypothetical, you know, is the Fed going to come under pressure to use those same powers again? And should they use those powers again? And it's worth talking about how limitless that power is.
Do you think the Fed has now, with inflation and with the pandemic and with even 2008, do you think it has slain the ghosts of Mariner Eccles and Paul Volcker and Greenspan?
I don't know if it's slain the ghosts. I think it's kind of like got all those ghosts hanging out all the time. It's like, this is like the Christmas Carol. The ghosts are there on a consulting basis, I'd say. So I think that, like, as in much of government, past is often precedent for the problems that face the Fed. You know, we thought we vanquished inflation forever, and as it turns out, we didn't. And so now we're spending a lot of time talking about Paul Volcker and his legacy. And so I think those ghosts are kind of always around a little bit.
If you want to know about Fed history or what it did during the pandemic and all that stuff in between, this is the book for you. It's called Limitless. It's by Gina Smilek. She covers the Fed for the New York Times, and she's on this program on Fridays every now and then. Gina, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
The Federal Reserve, of course, is not the only organization taking a good close look at the economy, trying to figure out what's going on and when, or if, important qualifier there, there might be a recession. Among the groups trying to figure it out, the National Association for Business Economics, which does a survey of its members to see where they think the economy is going. And the latest edition of that survey is out today, and 58% of said economists think we are likely to have a recession within the next 12 months. But when and how bad? Less clear. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
While a majority of economists do still think a recession is more likely than not,
they're not actually predicting a downturn in economic growth or in jobs being added in any quarter.
Ken Simonson is the chief economist for the Associated General Contractors of America and a spokesperson for NABE. He says rather than a soft landing or a hard landing or no landing,
I see this as touch and go, and that's both an aviation term for just touching down for a moment and then taking off, but also in the layman's terms of being very close to either a downturn or maybe we're not going to have one.
Good luck running a business based on that projection. Joe Feldman is a senior managing director at Telsey Advisory Group. To stick with the aviation metaphor,
there's a bunch of headwinds, not too many tailwinds, but a lot of just kind of in the middle type variables that are somewhat neutral.
He points to the strong retail sales in January that contradict warnings about consumers reining in their spending.
It's very confusing when the top economists in the world can't really agree on how the direction of the trends. It's extremely difficult for most of the companies and the retailers to come at it as well.
So if you're confused about where this economy is going, join the club. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Matt Levin started us off today with housing, which is a word that sometimes gets mixed up with home, because the thing is, you don't have to have a house to have a home, right? In fact, for more than 165,000 households in this economy, home is a van or an RV or a boat or some other kind of non-permanent structure. That's according to a Census Bureau estimate from 2 years ago. And those 165,000 households whose homes are transitory, that's the official term, is more than 15% higher than it was in 2019. That is the windup for today's installment of our series, Adventures in Housing.
I'm Brian Ostrovsky.
I am Shannon Ostrovsky.
And I live in Tennessee with my wife, Shannon, and our five kiddos.
At the beginning of 2020, we lived in a town called Folsom, California.
Having grown up in the foothills, it was pretty close to the area where we went to high school, where we met, and where our families are. But we did always think about the importance to us of wanting to see as much of the country as we could. And then we started having kids, and that seemed to be more and more challenging. And then we had five kids, and it seemed nearly impossible until an opportunity with work came up, and we decided we'd hit the road.
Jokingly, Brian says we were going to go 6 months, and I said in the beginning, I think it's going to be longer than that.
We started our travel with a travel trailer, which is a bumper pole, and a Ford Excursion, which is a three row. So we had no problem fitting there. We had got a very spacious travel trailer, but still a travel trailer, and modified it to basically have a modified bunk room to fit all of our kiddos and their various sizes.
I actually did a lot of route planning. He gave me specific cities that we have to hit for business. And then in between there, we sort of got to play with it and see, you know, what do we want to see? Made our way all the way to the Outer Banks in North Carolina. So we felt like that was a big accomplishment of from one coast all the way to the other coast.
So as we were getting to the end of 6 months, we faced this interesting challenge where our kids had grown and two of them barely fit their beds anymore.
I mean, kids grow, but we just didn't think that a couple of them would grow that many inches in that short of time.
So to continue traveling, we were able to sell our setup and buy a new to us truck and a new fifth wheel that gave us a much larger living space for the kiddos. And we ended up being on the road for 27 months.
Every place that we visit, we tried to really research. I would take the kids and we would go look at the local parks. Is there a library available? What does that look like? What do the schools look like? Home prices. Really tried to get a sense of, could this be home? So we eventually landed in Tennessee.
We spent $430,000 to buy this farmhouse. It has 36 acres of rolling hillside. About 25 acres of it is woods, but it's very old.
for us, I think the idea of home has definitely changed. I originally, when we were married and thinking about kids, and it was this perfect little house and the great entertaining space to have people over, and we're going to stay in this house forever. But now it's more of where we are in this moment and really enjoying what we have in the moment.
Brian and Shannon Ostrovsky, somewhere near Fayetteville, Tennessee. Tell us, would you, about your adventure in housing, whether it's on wheels or on the water, maybe you're anywhere else. Honestly, we'd love to hear from you. You can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, some reporting from the New York Times this afternoon about the CHIPS Act, that $50 billion semiconductor bill from a couple of months ago. The Times says the White House is going to announce tomorrow that chip makers who want a slice of that money, and they all do, are going to have to guarantee affordable, high-quality childcare for workers who build or work in those plants. It is fundamentally a labor force issue, right? All right, we are going. Here's your moment of economic context. Shares of Tesla were up 5.5% today. You know what that did? It made the guy who owns Twitter the richest person in the world again, $187.1 billion in net worth. That's according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.